Osiris.
RootslandNation.com. We're your culture.
I know. We've gone 6 seasons without any ads or commercials. It's been pretty great, right? The truth is that up till now, we haven't found a company whose values and products align with our show. But thanks to Sunset Lake CBD, that's changed. Sunset Lake CBD is a farm in Vermont that started out producing milk and cream for Ben and Jerry's ice cream. Then they diversified and started growing hemp for CBD. I know, most people usually start out with the cannabis before getting to the Ben and Jerry's. It's owned and run by the farmers who actually grow the hemp, with organic fertilizer using sustainable farming techniques. No herbicides, no pesticides. So you can be assured that this is the highest quality CBD and hemp products available. Don't waste your money supporting Big Pharma, or take a chance buying those gummies at gas stations or vape shops with questionable ingredients. Go to sunsetlakecbd.com and check out their top shelf line of gummy bears, edibles, tinctures, recovery lotions, and some beautiful sun-grown smokable hemp to put you in just the right state of mind for our show. And they even have a line of CBD for your pets to put them in the right state of mind for our show. Sunset Lakes CBD is a socially responsible company. They harvest, process, and ship product right from their farm in Vermont to your front door to keep prices as low as possible. We're proud to call them a sponsor and hope you'll support them by going to sunsetlakecbd.com and use the secret code ROOTSLAND.
The guy's right, just governed the world.
The Rootsland Podcast. Stories that are music to your ears.
Hey, what's going on, Curly? What's up, bro?
Yo, Enrique, Jano, the worst thing happened, bro.
What happened?
Man, the CD got leaked, man. The Stereo Top CD Volume 4 got leaked.
You mean the same one you gave me?
Yeah, it's everywhere.
What? Patrick, I've been gone for like 3 weeks. How does everyone on the island, how's it everywhere already? How does it go that quick?
It must be one of the engineers. It was recorded like about 3 or 4 engineers, and all of them are now saying that none of them are responsible for it.
Yeah, of course none of them are. No one's going to take responsibility, but that's nuts.
All right, so Henry, when are you getting back down here?
I'm coming down next week. I'll be down in about a week or so.
But this is serious.
Yeah, I know.
And by the way, did you listen to it yet, bro?
No, actually, things have been so busy, Patrick. I promise, before I get down there.
All right, bro, don't let us down, please.
I know.
You gave us your word, bro, remember.
Word is bond.
All right, Enrique.
It's truly amazing how fast you can spend $50,000 while recording in Jamaica. Studio time, musicians, guest artists, food, lots of food, entertainment, airfare, hotel. It would have been expensive, even if it was just me and Biga on our own. But of course, the suits at the label felt the need to fly down and oversee the project, which came out of our recording budget. In the end, Mercury Records would just write off the entire expense, as R&D. They had at least 10 other Biga stars signed to developmental deals, knowing darn well, if just one of them gets a hit song, that more than pays the cost for signing the other 9 artists, which in the end become expendable. These companies treated artists like they were clothing hanging on the racks and displayed on the shelves of an H&M store. The designs that sold, well, they were highlighted, kept around. The ones that didn't, they were dropped from the catalog or sat in the stockroom until clearance. It wasn't only singers and musicians that the labels would casually throw under the bus. These executives were ruthless, like tigers that ate their own cubs. Before I was even able to give Mercury Records the update about Biga, I found out the A&R guy that signed us to the deal, Nigel, had already been fired, replaced by a hungry assistant that was already doing his best to erase any memory of his former boss. A standard industry move. Which meant if Biga Star hadn't decided to move on, the decision would have been made for him. When the final credit card bills were tallied up and the check sent off, the feature artists and studio time paid, there was less than $100 remaining in the Biga Star recording fund. However, I did still have an unused portion of a round-trip plane ticket to Jamaica and 2 weeks prepaid at the Knutsford Court Hotel. Though Biga was out of the game for now, I was kind of just getting acclimated to being out on the field again, playing in front of a hometown crowd. Yeah, the game had undergone some changes in the years since I left. There were new players on the field, new coaches, new rules. There was one thing I was counting on. the same playbook.
Yo, what a go on, Enrique?
Harris, what's up, man? You look so dressed up. Thought it's Thursday's casual night at the Village.
Robert's got a fashion show and a bikini contest, so I've got to look my best, you know? I've got to look good.
Man, I was looking forward to a mellow night. Look at me, man, I'm wearing shorts and flip-flops. Everybody's going to be so dressed up in there.
Don't worry, Enrique. You know Jamaican. You know the complexion alone. You're going to look like a rich kid. Don't worry.
Yeah, I may look like a rich kid, but I'm a broke old man.
Don't worry yourself, man. Movements. Come on, let's go.
Thursday nights in Kingston is usually when the weekends start, especially if you have money to spend, which is probably why Harris's boss, Robert, picked it for his weekly fashion show and bikini contest at his Village Cafe in Ligony. The enterprising uptown youth was easily able to secure sponsorship and funding for his event from some of the island's most popular alcohol and cigarette brands. Incidentally, many were managed and run by Robert's high school buddies and their well-connected families. Finding models for the fashion show also required very little effort, since Robert also ran a modeling agency out of his family-owned barbershop and hair salon, conveniently located right next door to the Village Cafe. Turns out in a city like Kingston, it doesn't even cost much to hire young, beautiful women willing to parade down a makeshift catwalk in barely their bikinis and high heels in front of a house full of drunk businessmen and catcalling rich kids. You see, most of the models weren't even in it for the money, being that they were rich kids themselves, entitled daughters of Kingston's upper class, convinced they had the goods to be the Caribbean's next top model or represent their island as a future Miss Jamaica. And if not, they were happy to settle for second place, a wealthy, powerful husband. As it happens, Jamaica is a place where modeling and pageants play an integral and established part of mainstream popular culture. For such a small island, they've had a disproportionate amount of world-class beauties that have either won or been finalists in all the major international beauty pageants, including the very popular 1976 Miss World, Cindy Breakspear, whose father was a white Jamaican with French, British, and Sephardic Jewish ancestry. The young beauty's life would forever be changed while renting a room at Island House at 56 Hope Road in Kingston. There, she would fall in love with one of the property's other residents, a handsome singer named Bob Marley. The two would have an intense romance and relationship, resulting in the birth of Bob's youngest son, Damien Jr. Gong Marley. In 1992, Lisa Hanna would be the third Jamaican to win the title of Miss World, a former head girl at one of Jamaica's most prestigious prep schools. Besides her gorgeous face, stunning body, she had many other advantages that would help her to win her title. Advantages that were exclusively for Jamaica's most privileged and fortunate few. The ones that could afford the necessary grooming required to cultivate future beauty queens. From speech and etiquette classes, to lessons in posture, movement, and dance, to skincare, hair, and nail routines. The kind of preparations and experiences that would exclude working class and ghetto girls from having a fair shot. In many ways, Jamaica's talent and modeling industry, with its emphasis on white and light-skinned models with European features, was merely echoing the misguided sensibilities that were pervasive throughout the entire fashion world. There was a lack of diversity on runways and in ad campaigns, and an underrepresentation of dark-complected women with African features in general. It would not be until 1988 that the first black model would be featured on the cover of French Vogue magazine, a trailblazing 18-year-old girl from South London, abandoned by her father at birth, raised by her determined, hard-working, single Jamaican mom. Her name, Naomi Campbell, who ironically, or if you believe in destiny, began her career a decade earlier, at the age of 8, featured in the music video for Bob Marley's song, Is This Love? A song that Bob wrote for Cindy Breakspear. Naomi Campbell would face criticism, racism, and plenty of backlash on her way to become one of the very first supermodels. But the things that she endured opened the doors and provided inspiration for millions of dark-skinned girls around the world that dreamed of having modeling careers. And yet still in Jamaica, judging by the girls appearing in the fashion show, they still hadn't got the memo. Harris, you think it'll be much longer?
Just a few more minutes, Henry. I gotta lock up. You know, as security, I'm the one who has to lock up the place. But don't worry. After I lock up everything, Chris.
I know this is your gig, man. No worries. I'm starving, though. We can make a stop on the way back home,
right? Yeah, we stop at the Tiger Mart on our way back, you know?
Yeah, Tiger Mart. Dumpling. All right. Since Harris was the head of security, we couldn't leave the Village Cafe until it closed around 5 a.m. It was a weekday, and Kingston was just coming to life. Like any city with a million people, things start early, with street cleaners and sanitation workers, the food stalls and street vendors, buses and taxi men. Even before the sun had emerged from behind the Blue Mountains, Kingston had sprung to life. Which could only mean one thing. The fried dumplings at the Tiger Mart on Constant Spring would be hot out of the fryer, warm, doughy, fresh and ready for feasting. And as much as I thoroughly enjoyed the fashion show and some of Kingston's prettiest women, I was starving, and fried dumplings had been the only thing on my mind since 3 a.m. But as we pulled into the Tiger Mart gas station, there was a commotion as one of the buses were loading their morning commuters. Hey, Rude Boy Harris, what's going on up there? Is that a fight? Argument?
No, man, it doesn't look like a fight. It looks more like they're laughing.
No, they are.
Don't you think?
Yeah, they're laughing.
And they're having a good time, that's what I see.
Yo, that's the twin CD.
I was about to say that. I hear that
Patrick
tape everywhere.
He's telling me it's on the road everywhere. Have you been hearing it?
It's all over the place.
That's crazy.
It's on every corner.
That is nuts.
It's gone. It's all over the place.
As they say in Jamaica, I nammed off those dumplings before reaching the hotel. And when Harris dropped me off at the entrance, I was greeted by a taxi man who arrived at the hotel early. He was wearing a white tank top and wiping down his car with a rag, getting ready for the first ride of the day. His front door was open. I could see he had a dress shirt draped over the back of his driver's seat. And playing from his stereo, it was the same Twin of Twins that the bus was playing just 10 minutes earlier. When I got up to my room, I took out the twin CD from my backpack. It was in the same place I put it when Curly Locks first handed it to me. Well, I guess it was time for me to take a listen. I was the first one to get it, and now the last one in all of Kingston to actually listen.
The following program is rated E for entertainment. It contains graphic language and therefore parental discretion is advised. The storylines are purely fictitious, and the owners of the voices used are asked not to take offense.
And even if you do, we don't give a fuck.
Yes, we are here. We are back by popular demand with the popular program, Stir It Up. Yes, we're here for a... Back by popular demand. Yes, it's Curly Locks and Two Locks, aka Twin of Twins. And we're here imitating all these voices. And yes, it's very interesting tonight as a result of the fact that we're discussing two topics. We are discussing the uptown and downtown issue, the very controversial issue surrounding the dance hall and the slandering of these ghetto artists and the...
So before I get into Stirred Up Volume 4 and how listening to it that morning in my hotel room had such a profound impact on me, we need to go back to 1996, where Stir It Up all began, with volumes 1 through 3, an underground comedy cassette tape that evolved into an urban legend, a crackling distorted audio recording that was poor in quality, but amazingly rich in content and comedy. It appeared out of nowhere, and made the rounds from banged up cassette players in the trenches and gullies, to the high-end stereo systems in wealthy Jamaican suburbia. Along the way, blowing listeners away with its creativity, brash comedy, and biting social commentary. When Patrick Curly Locks Gaynor was still a child growing up in the ghetto, he found out there was a panacea for all the pain, suffering, and brutality that he witnessed going on around him. Something powerful enough to lift his spirits and help his friends and family escape the guns, bullets, and turmoil that filled their daily lives. A force of nature called laughter. As difficult as it was growing up in the garrison, there were times when Curly, Two Locks, their brother Deli, and friends would joke around until the early morning, at times laughing so hard it became painful to breathe. Curly could go on riffing for hours, telling stories, mixing in his jokes and voice imitations while he weaved his elaborate tales. He discovered a natural ability to imitate voices with his uncanny impression of his father, Mikey the Mechanic, an avid reader and ghetto philosopher, who would impart little pearls of wisdom to his sons on a regular basis. That in turn, Patrick would share with his Kingston 13 crew, Curly referred to his dad as a Google before Google.
Yeah, man, the piston and rings, you know, like oil did flow over, you know, that little cap, yeah, that little seal, yeah. Yeah, man, some oil did run over, you know, where the water, you know, supposed to be there, you know, supposed to be.
Eventually, the voice of Patrick's father morphed into an impersonation of Bob Marley, Jamaica's most well-known celebrity, who ironically had a speaking voice, very similar to Mikey the Mechanic. Other celebrity imitations quickly worked their way into his repertoire, ranging from Michael Jackson to Louis Farrakhan.
Yes, we're at the section of the program where we are going to speak to Michael Jackson via satellite. Yes, hello. Hello, line one. Hello.
Hello, Jamaica.
Michael, are you there?
Hello, Jamaica.
Yes, it's a pleasure to have you. Pleasure to have you, Michael.
You can stay there.
Yes.
You can stay there,
man. You see where you've been plagued with problems over the years.
Yes.
Problems with the Pavarotti, especially. Tell us, how come your life has been so tumultuous?
Well, as the world knows, I've been brought up in a broken home where I was constantly abused by my father, and he used to beat me all the time, you know, so...
Voila.
It led to a certain psychological...
Michael, yeah.
But what really complemented his impersonations and took them to the next level was Patrick's ability to become the character, take on the essence of the person he was imitating. A very close friend of the twins, Dwayne Psycho Christie, a Jamaican MacGyver and techno whiz, convinced Curly that he needed to record those same skits he had been performing on the ghetto streets. That same comedy, same social commentary, same voice impersonations. He felt a need to capture his friend Curly's material on tape and have it for posterity. You see, Psycho had seen the way Curly Locke's routine tore up Chisholm Avenue. His jokes turned hardened gangsters into jelly. His commentary and insights had killers, cold-blooded shottas rethinking their lives. Psycho, the mad scientist, set up a makeshift recording studio in his house, converting an answering machine to tape the session, and reverse engineering a speaker to create a microphone. Curly Locks didn't have an overactive imagination. He had a hyperactive imagination, creating a fictional radio show titled Stir It Up, an entire universe unto itself, with hosts, guest callers, music, social commentary. Curly played all the various parts, including Stirred Up's two most popular characters, the satirical radio show's polar opposite co-hosts, Ian Lyad and Mr. Muda. Two diverse individuals that represented the clash between Jamaica's uptown and downtown cultures. A hot topic in a country where classism is more prevalent than racism. Ian Lyad, one of the co-hosts of Curly's fictional radio show, according to himself, is the more educated and cultured of the two. A modified version of the Jamaican journalist and successful TV host Ian Boyne, one of the island's most admired and respected intellectuals. In contrast, Stirred Up's other co-host, Mr. Muda, is Curly's brilliant caricature of the legendary Rastafarian dub poet Muda Baruka, one of reggae's most fiery and confrontational personalities. Of course, Curly Locks' satirical version is rude and much more profane than the actual Muda, and enjoys taking verbal potshots at his uptown co-host, and on a regular basis, berates and belittles the guest callers. Recorded under the most primitive conditions, Stirred Up Volumes 1 through 3 contained some of the most progressive comedy and social commentary that Jamaica had seen in decades. It was like a Caribbean audio version of Saturday Night Live that parodied local personalities and current events. The satirical radio show quickly became an underground sensation, and with its original content, gave Curly and Two Locks a unique opening in a crowded and repetitive market. Still, the Twin of Twins would let this moment pass. You see, Curly Locks made a very deliberate decision at the time. And yes, his choice was heavily influenced by others around him, including his twin. But in the end, it was him that decided that Stir It Up and comedy would not be the direction that his career would take. At least not for now. As much as people love jokes and stand up in the ghetto, comedians didn't garner the same respect as musicians or singers or DJs. There was a stigma in the inner city that comedians were clowns, not to be taken seriously, especially the brand of comedy popular in Jamaica. It was physical, exaggerated, over-the-top humor, with costumes and props. Nothing like what Curly Locks envisioned his gangster comedy to be. He was a revolutionary thinker and refused to be perceived as goofy or idiotic. So for now, his vision was on hold. Almost a decade would pass by, and the twins who went viral, before there even was a viral, with their off-brand humor and their legendary underground mixtape, would go back blending into the tapestry of Kingston's music scene. Curly would prove to be an accomplished and gifted songwriter, penning hits for dancehall A-listers like Bounty Killer and Beanie Man. He'd learn that coming up with hit songs and catchy hooks was easy. Getting paid royalties and publishing rights you deserve? Much more difficult in a shady and corrupt system. Disappointment was like a third brother to the twins, who would occasionally have a door open long enough to see the bright light shining from inside the room, but just as quickly have it shut before they're able to enter. Then life changed for Patrick Gaynor in an amazing, astounding, and absolutely terrifying way when his longtime girlfriend Tiffany gave birth to their first child, a beautiful boy named Zion Emmanuel Gaynor. And finally, a small slice of sunshine poured into the dark corners of the Chisholm ghetto. Feeling the weight of this new responsibility, Curly Locks' career reached a crossroads. He made the choice. There was no way he would let Zion grow up in the same debilitating, impoverished conditions that he did. Curly found inspiration and encouragement from his son's mother, Tiffany, who convinced him he should forget trying to keep up with the Joneses and following others in the industry, that he needed to return to his roots, to stir it up, and the comedic skills that made him stand out from the pack. She reminded him of the riddle that was told to him years ago, a riddle that he had previously figured out. But in the madness and chaos and his desperate attempt to escape the ghetto confinement, he forgot, a mistake he vowed never to repeat. So he took what little money he had saved, booked some studio time, and began recording Stirred Up Volume 4. But unbeknownst to him, during the recording sessions, an overzealous engineer broke the cardinal rule of the music business and brought a copy of the twin CD home, just for private consumption, which of course didn't stay private for long and was leaked to the entire island. Now, all that hard work, all that money spent on recording, was for naught. And once again, Curly thought he was back at square one, right where he started. But this time around, there was something different. Me. Yo, Patrick, I loved it, bro. I love Stir It Up, man. How do you even think of something like that? Where do you even come up with that idea? And why do you wait 10 years to do a new one? What took so long?
Well, Henry, to be honest, it was my son's mother, Zion. You know, she reminded me of who I am, because I really forgot.
Wow, that's great that she keeps you grounded.
She told me that I was trying to fit in and not trying to stand out. And she told me that I wasn't born for that.
Uh-huh.
I was floundering that riddle.
What riddle? What riddle was she talking about?
Well, it goes all the way back to high school. When, you know, me and my brother was in the 10th grade. Our girlfriends who were in the 11th grade, Trisha and Claudette, they were graduating and the graduation ball was being held at the Jamaica Pegasus Hotel. It was a great night.
Oh, at the Pegasus? What a beautiful hotel. Wow.
Definitely is a great hotel. I can remember the night so clearly. You know, like success was in the air. It felt like success. It smelled like success. And there was this particular guy in a corner. Everyone surrounded him. He was very charismatic. And they held on to his every word. And in my mind, I was saying, I need to speak to this person. I felt that draw that I need to speak to this person. I had a lot of questions as it related to my music. So I introduced myself and my brother. I told him that we were just two youths from the ghetto trying hard, you know, and that I was an artist doing music, but that don't seem to work. And I wanted to know what he did and what he applied to his life that, you know, made his life such a success. And he said something to me that I will never forget. He said he was going to give me a riddle because he doesn't have to hear my music to know what I was doing wrong. And the riddle simply was, blaze a trail and leave a path.
blaze a trail and leave a path? Wow, that's deep. But it doesn't sound like a riddle. It sounds like a statement.
That's exactly what I said to him. But he said, you won't get the answer tonight. But later on, you will figure it out.
Well, judging by what I've heard, sounds like you've figured it out. But I hate to tell you, Stirred It Up 4, that's already out on the road. Everybody's got it. There's nothing you can do about it. Maybe it's time to blaze a new path. You have any ideas for a new album? Stirred Up 5?
What do you mean? I'm always way ahead of everything.
Yeah?
I already have the whole entire thing almost recorded on my recorder right here.
You do? What's it called?
It's called Crucifixion of the Ghetto.
The Ghetto, the Ghetto.
You think it's a joke? It's no joke. What this life is all about. You think it's the dope I smoke? Yeah. See here, I'm putting it out to tell you things are getting dread. Hunger is gonna kill some people dead. Price is gone out of reach. Even the I can't afford to preach. The cost of the living is running away. White squall is here to stay. And rising up more every day. That I am forced to say. You think it's a joke? It's no joke. What this life is all about. You think it's the dope that I smoke? Children are absent from school every day. Poor teachers can't get no pay. The health of the nation is on the decay. The doctors and nurses say, you think it's a joke? You think it's a joke? You think it's a joke? I'm not laughing. No, 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 no. I am skinning up.
Powered by RootslandNation.com. Listen to back episodes of the podcast. Stream original music. Check out the latest fashions. RootslandNation.com. We're your culture.